Welcome to Eastern Standard, produced for WEKU by Dynamics Productions. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for joining us. This week, a key question for all who have lost friends and even family to the seemingly deep political and philosophical divisions of our times.
Are we really just going to decide that we are going to be a divided country and there's going to be more than half of the population that we choose to not associate with?
Are we really that far apart?
When you actually drill down and ask them about their positions on issues, even things as seemingly contentious as guns or abortion, you actually find a lot of agreement.
So how can we find that common ground and repair those relationships? In this hour, Eastern Standard contributor Carolyn DuPont explores whether there remains any possibility of bridging divisions in our country, as well as whether those divisions are quite as real as some would have us believe. We know your time's limited. You may not have a full hour to spare. The individual interviews in today's edition are available for listening and sharing on our website, esweku.org. Now, here's Carolyn DuPont.
My guest today is Carissa Raskin, who is the CEO of the Listen First Project. So welcome to the program, Carissa.
Thanks so much, Carolyn, for having me.
I don't know that our listeners know about the Listen First Project, so please tell us all about it, what it does, what its mission is, how it does it.
Sure. Yeah, I'd be happy to. So Listen First Project is an organization that is a nonprofit. So we're a 501c3 and we are nationally based. So we don't focus on one particular area in the country. But our mission really is to hold space and build community across over 500 organizations that are committed to a common mission of bridging divides and decreasing what we call toxic polarization by increasing what we call social cohesion. So in other words, our main focus is to bring people together across differences through respect, building understanding, trust, and connection so that we are able as communities, a country, and a society at whole to lean into collaboration over contention and build a more thriving community.
I mean, it sounds fabulous. I think those are things that we all want. And of course, anybody listening to this is going to know that those things seem in short supply and that there are not a lot of organizations and outlets that are encouraging those things. And in fact, they're encouraging the opposite. So let me ask you, how does Listen First actually work? So what kinds of projects do you initiate? How are you going about fulfilling this mission?
Our organization is a bit unique in that we serve as what is considered the backbone of the bridging field or movement, as some people call it. And so actually what you just shared, Carolyn, that, you know, there aren't a lot of organizations that are promoting this. What we've found is there's actually a lot more that are than is commonly thought. And we've found this by building our Listen First Coalition. And that's really the premise on which Listen First Project was built, not to necessarily create new programs or develop new trainings, but to lift up and amplify the work of everyone else who is already doing this. And very importantly, create that sense of community among all of these different organizations. When you're in this work and you don't know that other people are doing it, it can feel even more daunting than it does when you know that there are others doing it. It's quite lonely.
Yeah.
So we've found that through building a coalition where organizations, large and small, researchers, small nonprofits, even some for-profits, have the ability to be in regular communication and connection with each other and to work collaboratively on shared goals, programs, and projects, we're able to achieve greater impact together by building our capacity, but we also just feel a stronger sense of resilience against the forces that are striving to tear us apart. And we have found that everyday Americans, when they find out about this coalition of over 500, that tends to be a powerful number for them, that really they feel like there's more hope just by knowing that there are more out there. So to answer your question, you know, what do we do? We have four main functions at Listen First Project, and I'll go through them briefly. So really, it's that sense of community. We build community amongst other partners that are committed to this work. We provide coordination. And so there's 1,000 different things happening, and they all are great, but we can make greater impact together if we're a little bit more coordinated and strategic in our efforts. So we've been able, through partnership with other leaders in the field, to be able to develop coordinated, collaborative strategies and initiatives that focus on either a particular gap in our field or a particular area that's needed to be addressed. And so we get to serve as, we lovingly say, cat herders at times, really project managers, to be able to help facilitate those collaborative and coordinated processes. The amplification piece that I just mentioned is our third core function. We always try to lift up others. And if you visit our website, we have a page of our coalition members, and it's just tons of logos of other organizations doing this work. And then the fourth and really important function that we serve is to help provide a tool for assessment, because it's really good to do good work, but it's even better when you can prove that it's doing what you set out to do. It's better for people who are very data-driven. It's better for skeptics who may not think this is of value, or might, you know, fall into the realm that thinks this is too kumbaya or, you know, pie in the sky.
Yes.
And then it's also really important for us, for our own internal edification, to know we are putting our time and energy into things that are actually achieving what our goals are, you know, reducing that effective polarization, building that social cohesion and sense of belonging. So we've been able to develop a research validated tool that we can customize and offer to all organizations in our space, and sometimes even beyond, that are striving to bridge divides and help them to know whether they're actually achieving their goals.
We've been talking about Listen First and what it does. And I want to just move a little bit to the whole notion of bridging divides and listening and why that matters. Because it seems that today what we hear a lot about is that we need to resist. There are a lot of forces telling us to resist. Perhaps resistance does have a place, but you recommend a different strategy. And so why is listening to others the thing to do right now instead of resisting?
Well, I think what our country is facing right now is honestly a product of resistance. Mm-hmm. We are all stuck in our own echo chambers, feeding off of the consistent messaging that is most prominent in our, what, you know, some may call a tribe. And we know that the only path forward, as, you know, shown by our founding fathers even creating the documents that founded our country, is there has to be ability to talk across difference, find common ground. We are a, as our colleague Eboo Patel from Interfaith America would say, we are a potluck nation. We are a bunch of very different people with different backgrounds who are striving to live in a country where we can thrive together. If we are resisting each other, we are never going to be able to accomplish that. And so, true to your point that there are times, absolutely, that all manners of, you know, work, whether it's advocacy, resistance, you know, the people talk about the bridge, block, build philosophy, all of those things do have a place. But what we really believe at Listen First, and what we have seen in the data, is that people are not as divided as they are led to believe, and they absolutely want to be able to talk across differences more than they currently are. And even more than talk across differences, People want to be able to work together on solutions for their community. They want to have common goals. They want to build connection. They feel afraid and they feel without opportunity to do so. So when we are, you know, in our field, emphasizing this approach of listening with, and it's not just listening to respond. It's not listening to already have pre-planned, you know, your debate rhetoric that you're going to spit back real fast. It's listening truly with curiosity and empathy to deeply understand, because we all have our own bias. We all have our own story and perception. But if we're able to check some of that at the door and go into a conversation with that sense of curiosity, knowing we're not striving to agree, we're just trying to understand a bit more why the other person is coming from where they are, it is likely that we're going to find threads in what they say that resonate with us, common values, common things that we care about as well. Maybe a different perspective on it, maybe a different experience that led us to the final point we came to, but still common sense of humanity and dignity. And when we can lean into that dignity, it makes us a better version of ourselves. It reduces our stress responses, and we don't feel the need to be as resistant to others.
I love talking about listening, and I think many of us do work to listen, but I've discovered that listening in the ways that you're describing is actually hard. Why is it hard?
Well, because I think, you know, our society, especially of late, is programmed to be in a situation where a couple of things, you know, we, as I said, we're programmed with the rhetoric that it falls in our echo chamber. And so the things that we hear constantly are the things that we start to believe. And also we're human. So we like heuristics. We like shortcuts. We like things that make sense to our brain that can get us from A to Z a lot faster than going through the whole alphabet, right? And so taking that time to truly listen is not something that we are necessarily trained to do, and not something naturally in our neuroscience of our brain that we would typically do. And so it's an easier pathway. It also has a lot to do, I think, with cognitive dissonance. If we are in a position where we are listening deeply with curiosity and are then in a position where there might be something being said by somebody who is our quote unquote other that reigns true with us, whoa, that's scary. Like, did they just say something that resonates with me? Well, what does that mean about me? What does that mean about the things that I've believed in? What does that mean about the things that I've advocated for? Does this make me somebody who no longer believes in the value system? And I think it calls into question a lot of people's own values and morals. And it can be scary to grapple with that on our own. It can be even scarier when you feel like you are a part of a quote unquote tribe that would then push back on you for defying or questioning the things that are supposed to be true for you and your tribe.
Yeah. It's kind of like identity threat. And then that's when we get angry when all of that is threatened.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And that's why, you know, political polarization and really any type of toxic polarization is having such a detriment on our mental health. It's not even just about being angry at other people. Like, you are in some levels at a self-preservation mode, trying to preserve your own identity and your sense of connection and community. Because as you mentioned very correctly early on, there is a lot of media and propaganda out there that would prefer to see us stay divided into tribes rather than bring us together.
They benefit from it.
Yes.
At our expense.
Indeed.
So, you know, I've had conversations about talking across the divide, bridging divides, and sometimes I get a response, well, you know, that's all Pollyanna, kumbaya. It's nice, but it's not practical and it's not going to help us. So how do you respond to that?
Well, if I can channel a bit of the founder of Listen First Project, you know, when I have asked even questions like this to him in past years, he said, what's the alternative? Yeah. Are we really just going to decide that we are going to be a divided country and there's going to be more than half of the population that we choose to not associate with? Are we going to divide off into factions in our society and not be truly America anymore? Because if that's the case, then sure, why bother talking if we're really okay with being that divisive? But the call in America is for people to come back together across difference. And so some may say it's kumbaya. As you pointed out very aptly, the things that we are asking people to do are not easy. People aren't getting together to sit around a fire circle and hold hands and roast marshmallows and, you know, become best of friends. We're talking about really critical issues. We're talking about abortion. We're talking about gun violence. We're talking about race. We're talking about all manner of things. And that is not a comfortable situation to be in. So I can't exactly agree that it feels kumbaya, but the outcomes of it is a thriving, resilient community that is able to come up with solutions for issues that are directly impacting their workplaces, their schools, their families, their faith institutions. And without being able to have those really difficult conversations, we're going to live in isolation, fear, a loneliness pandemic, and at worst, potentially violence.
Yeah.
I just don't see an alternative.
I think you're right. And the alternative is pretty scary. So
it is.
Well, thank you so much for introducing our listeners to the Listen First Project. I hope people will check it out online. And thank you so much for taking the time to talk with us.
Oh, thank you, Carolyn. It was my pleasure.
Carolyn, you just talked with Carissa Raskin of the Listen First Project, and there are lots of these groups working in the depolarization space, if you will. But is that well known?
It's not well known, and I think that it should be. It says something about our media environment that what we hear more about is polarization. We hear more about the opposition, that everything we hear leads us to believe that people hate one another. And in fact, there are a number of these groups that are working kind of under the radar, and I think it would be really helpful to all of us if we had a connection with some of these groups to help us realize that on an individual basis, we certainly don't hate one another and that we actually agree on a lot. But you have to work to find that. And I think that's a shame.
We don't really learn how to do this, do we?
No. In fact, a lot of things that we don't learn, we learn certain things, but then as we get older, hopefully we discover there's a countervailing truth. But I think that bad learning is being reinforced right now because we don't have attention to the good work that's going on with people who are working purposefully to build bridges.
Well, Carissa talked about something that I would think would be key to this whole deal, and that is meaningful listening.
Yeah. Meaningful listening. Some people call it active listening. It's absolutely crucial. And I think we all know that it's not happening among high-profile political leaders. We don't see any models for listening. And our leaders are modeling shutting people down, owning the other side, destroying the other side, instead of actually listening to the other side. And I think that that is a really important way to disrupt the polarization that's going on. And I wish we had more models for it that got a lot of attention.
Well, listening is quite a challenge in one of these discussions because typically you're thinking about what you're going to say while you're listening, and that can be quite a trick.
Yeah.
Listening in a way that can help us understand those opposing views takes work. It takes skill. What are those skills, and how can we develop them for ourselves?
Well, we won't develop them without intentionality, without thinking about it. And I'm hoping that we can link to some literature on the webpage that really does talk about how to listen actively. But I think a couple of postures that you have to adopt is, number one, you really just have to let go of any wish to change the other person's mind. That's a mindset, but it's also an attitude toward another person. If they think what they think, well, let them think that. And every one of us thinks things for a reason, believes things for a reason. So if we can drop that wish to mold them to our way of thinking and really try to get to the assumptions, the values that underlie those opinions. And, you know, of course, maybe they've got some misinformation that's informing what they think, but you know what? Probably we have a little misinformation. So I think the first thing is just dropping the agenda of converting them to our way of thinking. And you even said it a minute ago, thinking about what we're going to say next. We do that because we want to change their minds. We want to show them that they are wrong. You know, if we just can let that go and really dig into what's behind it, it can be quite liberating, and it can really be affirming for that other person when you've really tried to understand them.
It's really helpful, and we will link to those books. You'll find them on our website.
Great. Thanks.
Coming up after the break, something very useful in these highly opinionated times.
Intellectual humility. And that's simply being open to the possibility you might be wrong.
Dana Goldthwait-Young, she's Carolyn DuPont's next guest. She's written a book on how our media, politics, and identity all combine to drive our appetite for misinformation.
We tend to see around us those things that confirm what we want to believe to be true already. We tend to recall information that's consistent with our beliefs. We interpret things in ways that are consistent with our beliefs.
I'm Tom Martin, and you're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU. This is a WEKU History Moment. History worth hearing. WEKU's listening area includes 10 transmitters, ranging from 10-watt local translators all the way up to 50,000 watts of power on our main WEKU tower. If you were to stack all of our towers end-to-end, they would stretch more than a mile at 6,200 feet. That's deeper than the Grand Canyon, taller than Kentucky's Black Mountain, and longer than 65 basketball courts. Help WEKU continue making history. Join our 1850 campaign. We need 1,850 supporters to give $10 a month and strengthen the station for the future. Find out how you can support us online at weku.org. You're listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU. I'm Tom Martin. And Carolyn DuPont is back with a conversation that explores what seems to have become an appetite for misinformation, how that's happened, and how we might not be as divided over big, important issues as it so often seems.
My guest is Dana Goldthwait-Young, a scholar of communication studies and political science at the University of Delaware, and the author of Wrong: How Media, Politics, and Identity Drive Our Appetite for Misinformation. Welcome to the program, Dana.
Thanks for having me.
So your fascinating book, as the title suggests, unpacks the complexity of misinformation and why people believe it. And in the first half, you explore our own thinking processes, which are not as simple as we think. So talk a little bit about how our own observations of the world are not as neutral as we wish they were.
Well, unfortunately, because we're all ego-driven and we all are protective of our own psychological needs, we have skin in the game when we're looking at out at the world. And so not only are the beliefs and values that we hold things that we usually embrace to protect us in some ways. Literally, the very observations that we make of the world around us are also informed by those needs. You know, there was a philosopher of science named Norwood Russell Hansen who suggested that all observations are already laden with our theories, right? They're theory-laden observations. And I think this is very true and describes things like motivated reasoning and confirmation bias, right? Where we tend to see around us those things that confirm what we want to believe to be true already. We tend to recall information that's consistent with our beliefs. We interpret things in ways that are consistent with our beliefs. But I take this a step further, and I think about this in terms not only of our pre-existing theories and beliefs informing what we see, but our social identities shaping what we see. And to do this, I build on some wonderful work. There's a book called The Power of Us by Packer and Van Bavel. And they describe some excellent experimental work that shows when you change the way that people think about what team they're on, but just by highlighting or priming their membership to different kinds of teams, like based on their ethnicity or based on their state of origin, their hometown, their country, you shape their perceptions of the world around them. So that's why we're not really neutral. We're not neutral observers, and we will see the world in keeping with whatever team identity is activated within us.
I mean, that's really sobering. And many of us like to think, well, we just, you know, we rely on the evidence. We see things in front of our own eyes, and any idiot can see this, and that's all there is to it. But it's really not that simple. I love how you come back to this idea that we all have a drive for comprehension, control, and community. And those play a role in our thinking.
Correct. So this is what I call the three C's, is a way of really efficiently summarizing loads of research from social psychology. And these I describe as the fundamental motivations that drive us. Because at the end of the day, we are hardwired for survival. We want to survive. And if you believe that any of the tenets of evolutionary psychology are true, we have evolved over time in ways that reward the things that have aided in our survival. And generally, those are things that empower us to take action. So what allows us to take action in the face of threat? Well, understanding or comprehending what the hell is going on would be first, right? You cannot do anything if you cannot summarize efficiently for yourself what is happening, right? So cause and effect relationships, what causes what, explaining, having some narrative of explanation for what is happening. Number two is we do not feel like we have the ability to act until we feel that we have control or agency over the situation. So number two is simply we're motivated to feel like we have control. And number three is the notion that we cannot survive alone, that people historically who have been operating at odds with their social communities don't survive. Right? We literally need people to have our back. We survive in groups because then we're able to capitalize on the strengths of other people in our group who are able to do things and bring skills to the table that we maybe don't have. And in the face of what some call sort of threatening, hostile coalitions of outgroups, which, you know, I don't know if you know, but the history of humankind has not been particularly peaceful, right? So we've been at odds with other groups of people
pretty
historically.
Constantly. Yes.
Yeah. So when you have hostile coalitions of outgroups that you fear might come over the hill at any point in time, you need to know that your people have your back and that you are a part of a group that will fight with you and by your side. So those are the three C's. You need to feel like you get it, comprehension. You need to feel like you have control, right? And you have to feel like you have community. And those are the C's that guide us. The trouble is our primal minds cannot discern whether we actually have accurate comprehension, whether we actually have control and whether we actually have meaningful community. We just like to perceive that we feel like we do. And to the extent that some kind of fiction satisfies those needs, even if it's a lie, right? To the extent that it satisfies those needs, that helps us feel like we can survive another day.
And so everything we think in some way helps us with each of these three C's that you've identified. Yeah. So another aspect of the complexity of our own perceptions is our team. And how does our team shape our perceptions, and how do we come to identify who's on our team?
Yeah, that's sort of the fundamental question, right? And it's changing all the time. We all have a lot of different teams that we identify with. I always will say, so I grew up in New Hampshire, and that being a Granite Stater, being a New Hampshireite is a very big part of who I am. But I've lived in New Jersey for 20 years. And I don't think of myself as like a Jersey girl until I am required to stick up for New Jersey. So if someone says something really mean about New Jersey, all of a sudden, I am a Jersey girl and I defend New Jersey and the things that are great about it. I also am, you know, I'm a mom. I'm a faculty member. All of these are parts of who I am. But I think the New Jersey example is a good one because I don't think of myself as a Jersey girl until that identity is threatened. When people say, oh, New Jersey, it's all highways, it's all this, it's all, you know, it's gross, people are rude. All of a sudden, that identity is super activated because I'm like, who are these people to judge this team that I am on? And that really illustrates that the best way to activate someone's social identity is to threaten it. And once you threaten someone's social identity on a given team, all of a sudden they're wearing that hat. Though that's the hat they're wearing, or those are the glasses they have on that are then shaping how they see the world. Just because you've threatened it, now it's activated.
Wow. Well, there's a lot more we could explore on each of those ways that our thinking is more complex than just simply, oh, we see a truth and we embrace it. But in the second half of your book, you take all of that and show how the media, especially today's media, I would use the word exploits our humanity, really, these very human things about us. And so I want to focus on that a little bit. There is this notion that media reinforces our beliefs, but you argue that the way that it reinforces our beliefs has actually changed over time as the media landscape has changed. So can you talk about that a little bit?
Absolutely. What I do in the first half, as you say, I talk a little bit about individual psychology and the way that we come to understand the world. I also talk a bit about the unique history of the United States and our politics in the United States. I talk about our two major political parties that have shifted over time. I talk about this process that folks may kind of know. I think a lot of people hear political polarization as the term of art. Which is happening among political elites in Congress who are getting more extreme and more pure in their ideological votes in Congress. But what's happening among the mass public is quite different. It's what we call social sorting, which is that the two parties have become more distinct along the lines of fundamental aspects of identity, including race, ethnicity, religion, geography, right? So the Republican Party is increasingly, over the last 50 years, white, evangelical, Christian, rural, and culturally conservative, whereas the Democratic Party has grown increasingly racially and ethnically diverse, secular and agnostic, more suburban and urban, and more progressive, politically liberal. So what that means is that you don't just have two parties that believe different issue positions. You have two parties that are home to different types of people, categories of people. And unfortunately, because we do have primal motivations, when our politics correlate with these really core socio-demographic categories, religion, geography, race, It activates something very deep within us and makes those political identities even more powerful, even more salient, even more motivating and driving for us. This is bad for democracy. It's bad for society. It's bad for relationships. It's bad for communities. Okay. What it's great for, though, it's great for media organizations. Why? Because their entire economic structure is based on the buying and selling of little homogenous groups of people to advertisers. Homogenous groups that are really emotionally activated by keywords and images and threats. Well, if you have two political parties that are have become so distinct and have different value systems that move them, who start to see the other side as the enemy, you can imagine, yeah, bad for democracy, really good for Facebook, really good for X, really good for cable news organizations. So those dynamics, I say, are sort of self-reinforcing. And the reinforcement patterns that happen are reinforcement in the direction of like increasing how much we think of ourselves as members of our team over and over, distilling our identity down to its purest, most extreme, emotionally laden nugget. All bad, democratically speaking.
So we're not thinking of ourselves as Americans, but we're thinking of ourselves as conservatives or as evangelicals or as rural people or as urban people or as intellectuals or whatever it may be.
And a lot of those things cluster together. Liliana Mason, Johns Hopkins, describes these as mega identities that kind of these big umbrellas of left and right that signal all kinds of different things, right? The left is, you know, more educated, lives in urban areas, you know, they represent like higher ed and you know, Hollywood and, you know, all this. And then the right, which represents like working class, people who work with their hands, the trades. When you look at democratic theory literature from across the globe, folks will say that one of the biggest dangers, there are many dangers for democracies. Wealth inequality is one of them. Polarization is another. Another huge problem for democracies long-term is when political parties map onto religion or race, because it becomes political sectarianism. And it becomes very difficult for democracy to thrive when the political differences are correlated with religion, especially religion.
Mm-hmm. It's such a deep identity.
Correct.
Yeah. And it strikes me that this is, you haven't mentioned the word issues at all. It seems like it doesn't have anything to do with issues or policy.
I know. Now, of course, it does to some extent, mm-hmm. right? There are some issues that do fall from it. But the part that brings me so much hope, actually, is that even when you look at Americans who fall under these two umbrellas, and, you know, they might check all these boxes and, you know, this is, you know, a caricature of a Republican over here, a caricature of a Democrat over here. When you actually drill down and ask them about their positions on issues, even things as seemingly contentious as guns or abortion, you actually find a lot of agreement. And people say, are you sure that's true? That is empirically true. So that's where I do have hope, because when you talk about policy and you talk about issue positions, there is a lot of overlap. The disconnect is on these aspects of who we are and how we think of ourselves and what team we're on, but not about how we want to solve this country's greatest problems.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's just so fascinating. And I'm also thinking about how many pop culture icons or, you know, songs or books have aspects of identity in them. You're so right that it really does seem to be about activating identities. Well, you said the word hope, and let's end up there, because I think that we all want to hear that there's hope. And you spend a whole chapter on how we can disrupt these forces that are sorting us even further, driving us further apart. So how can we do that, and how can we derive hope from that?
I'll just stick with the individual mechanisms, because I think that people, regular folks, just want to know, what are ways that I can shift some of these dynamics? Mm-hmm. Can I? And the answer is yes. And you can do it every single day with every interaction you have with every human being every day. And there are three practices. One is what I call reshuffling the deck. Reshuffling the deck involves doing what you can to disrupt how bifurcated these two teams have become. And that involves changing how you perform and represent your own political identity. You might find, for example, that you feel kind of compelled to only speak up online about those issues that you know you share the same position as the rest of the folks on your team. Well, imagine if you spoke up in the minority voice to say, yeah, I generally am on this side. However, with this particular issue, I see things a little bit differently. What if the other side has a point on this issue? Now, it's uncomfortable. You have to recognize that you're going to get pushback because it does contradict the sort of ethos of online culture. However, I've taken to seeing it as a democratic responsibility to always throw a wrench in the works of the platforms. Because what you're doing is you're making it clear that these two giant mega identities are not as pure as they may appear, right? I think about it as an exercise in democratic health. Another one is giving the benefit of the doubt, which means never allowing yourself to pigeonhole someone and put someone in a box just because they do check a lot of boxes. You know, you look at someone who drives a truck and they have a gun rack and you say, oh, well, this person's not like me, or maybe this person's just like me. Well, what if instead of allowing those things to inform your view, you recognize that statistically speaking, that person, regardless of what they drive or how they dress or what music they listen to, they probably share a lot of issue positions with you. That is statistically true. And so if you allow that to lead, it's going to change how you interact with that person, right? Changing how you think about who the average member of the other party is, because the average member of the other party is probably way more moderate and similar to you than you would ever believe. And the third tactic is what I call, well, in the literature, it's called intellectual humility. And that's simply being open to the possibility you might be wrong. Navigating the world from a place of curiosity and being constantly willing to update your views, not to compromise your values or deny anyone's humanity, but to always be open to the possibility that the concrete beliefs you hold, the knowledge you hold, might be inaccurate. And if you operate your life like that in a truth-seeking way, on a truth-seeking mission, you'll become closer to truth.
Boy, I think that's so important. I like to say I am most certainly wrong about something. I just need to figure out what it is. and then I won't
that's
be
right.
wrong about it anymore.
That's right.
goodness, those are such hopeful and really empowering ideas because, as you know, we can do them ourselves every day. And there's so much more we could talk about here, and unfortunately we have to stop. But I do hope that listeners will check out Wrong: How Media, Politics, and Identity Drive Our Appetite for Misinformation by Dana Young. So thank you again for being with us.
Thank you so much, Carolyn.
Carolyn, following up on your conversation with Dana Goldthwait-Young, do you get the impression that we could all stand a work on critical thinking?
Boy, could we. And it's interesting about critical thinking. You know, all of us believe that we do it and nobody else does. And when people talk about critical thinking, a lot of times that just means we'll think like I think. It's helpful to dig into what critical thinking actually is, what are the obstacles to it, and really to ask yourself, what are the ways in which I'm not doing it, and to have an attitude of humility about it, because all of us, every one of us, is subject to the forces that want to keep us in our thought bubbles and in our political bubbles.
I think it's really interesting when you get into these discussions how people can look at the very same bit of evidence and see it completely differently.
Yeah, even when we think there's only one way to see it. And, you know, that's kind of why the other aspect of this that we talked about a few minutes ago about active listening can really be helpful, because sometimes, often even, there are legitimate always there are legitimate other ways to see something that maybe we didn't think of. And I think what she said, the fact that we have skin in the game, we have an interest, we have something at stake in seeing an issue or an incident or a person in a certain way. And this works against our ability to really think in critical and rational ways.
There are many polls out there that tell us that we as Americans actually agree about a lot, but we're led to believe that we don't agree.
Yeah, I think this is so important, because if you talk with someone who's quote unquote on the other side and do it in a non-confrontational way, what you often find, or at least I'll say my experience has been, that absolutely we agree on so much. And when you think about our current polarized situation, what's the issue? Well, the truth is there's not a single issue. And we can think back to times when we've been very polarized in our country. And I mean, of course, the one that comes immediately to mind is the Civil War. We all knew what the issue was then. It was slavery. But what's the issue now? There's not a single issue. There's kind of a constellation of issues. But even in that constellation of issues, when it comes down to what actually needs to happen, Americans agree a lot more than they disagree.
The media, and I use that term carefully here because not all media does what I'm about to suggest. Yeah. I would like to think that public media is excluded from this criticism, but media exploits our human vulnerabilities. And that's one of the key factors that drives this polarization, isn't it?
Well, it is. It's also that so much of our media in the United States is built on the commercial model. And so that's why I think public media has been able to exempt itself to some extent, because it's not driven by clicks and by having to get sponsors in the commercial way that the big networks are. In a recent interview, not one of the ones today, I remember one of the guests said that we all get a toxic thrill from hatred. And we don't, of course, like to admit that about ourselves. But the media capitalizes on that instinct that we have. You know, how badly is this person behaving today? And if I throw you some bait that's going to suggest, oh my, they've really gone over the top, well, we kind of like that. And so we'll click on it. And so the media has a financial incentive to put those things in front of us and to present things in that very polarized way. So, yes, the media absolutely is a culprit. Now, there are sources out there, public radio, public television, and some Substack writers that are really doing good work. And I think it's really valuable to try to connect with those kinds of sources and let that be your media diet.
Well, Carolyn, as we wrap up the hour, I'd like to pick your brains for a moment. What are your own strategies for rebuilding bridges in this country?
Well, let me say, first of all, I'm still working on this, but I think that I think about it in terms of internal things that I do internally and then things that I do externally. So internally, I purposefully look for, you know, if something happens and the media that I prefer interprets it one way, I'll ask myself, is there another way to think about this? Maybe I'll try to read some news stories that come from the other side. I've read a lot of literature about our brains and how we think and why we tend to, why we all are subject to groupthink more than we realize. So that's one internal strategy. I think the external strategy would be twofold, and probably after this I'll think of more, but two that come immediately to mind. One is cultivating individual relationships with people who I know don't vote like I do. And this has been just absolutely crucial for me. When you begin to care about somebody because you associate with them on somewhat of a regular basis, it really changes how you think about them. And you hopefully developed a sense of respect for, you know, I'm thinking of a couple of friends of mine, just their sheer decency. And now when people talk about the other side and they say things like that they're dumb or they're cruel, you know, I think of friends that I've made and I think, you know, that's not David. That's not Jamie. That's not Dawn. I know they're not dumb. And I know that they are decent people that made certain decisions based on values that they had that they thought were expressed in their vote. And so I think cultivating those relationships, because what we start to think if we don't have any relationships on the other side is we think everyone thinks like us. And then, of course, our truth is the obvious truth. The other thing that I think is really important is, for me, has been the Braver Angels group that I help lead in Jessamine County. And we're, you know, over the last 4 years, about 45 people have connected with us at one point or another. And I think it's important for people to know that they can start a group like this on their own. And if anybody wants some advice on how to do that, I'd love for them to reach out to me. My email is in the show notes. But we meet regularly and intentionally. And we have some hard conversations, and sometimes we have to kind of stop and say, okay, we've gone in a direction here we didn't want to go in. But I just so value those conversations. And so I think those are two ways that people can disrupt the polarization that is just pulling us into its vortex every day.
Well, Carolyn, thank you so much for these conversations that you've brought to us and also your own observations. We really appreciate it.
Well, thank you for hosting this series of conversations.
You can find all the interviews in Carolyn DuPont's series, as well as those of our many other series hosts, online at esweku.org. Just go to the Contributors and Series tab, click on that, and you'll get a drop-down menu listing our ever-growing archive. Thanks for joining us. Eastern Standard is produced at the studios of Dynamics Productions. Mike Savage, executive producer, Neil Kesterson, sound designer and technical director, Ella Fitzgeraldine, studio dog. You can find all of the interviews from this week's edition online at esweku.org. And while you're there, you can check out our archive, our contributors and their interviews, and you can sign up for our newsletter. You can find Eastern Standard on weku.org, on the WEKU app, and podcast versions are on Apple, Spotify, and the NPR app. Want to call something to our attention or suggest a topic? Our email is es@eku.edu. I'm Tom Martin. Thanks for listening to Eastern Standard on WEKU.